It is Monday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Defense Secretary tells Pakistan to redouble its efforts to confront militants on its soil.
It's the sanctuaries on Pakistani soil, according to U.S. officials, that have been detrimental to the U.S.-led international efforts to secure and stabilize Afghanistan.
President Donald Trump's son-in-law says the president is close to making a decision on declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel, and the latest installment in the Star Wars film series is released a year after the death of one of its stars. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis urged Pakistan Monday to redouble its efforts to confront militants and terrorists operating within the country. He emphasized the vital role Islamabad can play to work with Washington to facilitate a peace process in Afghanistan. Mattis arrived in Pakistan on a day trip and went into meetings with Prime Minister Shahid Khaqan Abbasi and the military chief, General Qumar Javed Bajwa. I asked reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad whether the U.S. is stepping up pressure on Pakistan regarding terrorism.
It's not impression. In fact, the U.S. officials have already made it very clear ever since President Donald Trump announced his new Afghan strategy that it's the sanctuaries on Pakistani soil, according to U.S. officials, that have been detrimental to the U.S.-led international efforts to secure and stabilize Afghanistan. And that has been a major irritant in bilateral relations. And ahead of Mattis' visit, the American CIA chief made it very clear that if Pakistan does not take action against those sanctuaries on its soil, then the U.S. will take care of those sanctuaries on its own. So obviously, Pakistan has been under a lot of pressure. So what we have seen from the statements issued after the meeting, they sounded positive and that both sides want to cooperate and work together. But we may not be able to know exactly what transpired in the discussions between the Army Chief of Pakistan and Mattis' delegation.
Well, meanwhile, Prime Minister Shahid Abbasi, he has said that there are no safe havens in Pakistan and that the country is committed to eradicate terrorism once and for all. So it sounds like there's a bit of a different perspective there between the Pakistani and U.S. sides.
Yes, publicly, that's what Pakistan has been insisting over the last few years, that, you know, its counter-terrorism forces have cleared all militant sanctuaries on its soil and that those militants have now fled to Afghanistan. And because there is a huge ungoverned area in Afghanistan, either under the influence or controlled by the Taliban. So this is what Pakistan has been saying, that those sanctuaries no more exist on its soil. But, you know, that narrative from the Pakistani side has not apparently been acceptable to the U.S. And this is also, to some extent, true in a way that there are 3 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan, and Pakistani officials do not rule out the possibility of militants hiding in these refugee populations on its soil. So that is what actually the U.S. officials refer to, that these militants are still moving back and forth across this long border between the two countries and orchestrating militant attacks in Afghanistan. But that's what Mattis said before arriving in Islamabad. He will be trying to find some wider ground between the two sides and common ground so that they can work together. But as we know, that U.S. wants to put pressure on Pakistan, but there has to be a limit for that pressure, because U.S. forces and NATO forces in Afghanistan, which are almost 16,000 in numbers currently, they heavily rely on the ground and air lines of communications for supplies through Pakistan. And that is why if U.S. goes ahead and puts too much pressure on Pakistan by conducting some serious drone strikes on Pakistani soil, obviously those air and ground lines of communication will be threatened. Pakistan may block them. So that is why apparently the Trump administration is trying to find, through diplomatic efforts, a way where Pakistan can be persuaded to take action against those sanctuaries on its soil.
Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, the big story on Friday, people are still talking about it today on social media, is former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pleading guilty on Friday to lying to the FBI. Today, the big topic of conversation is about a tweet that President Trump sent out over the weekend about this. On Sunday, he tweeted that he had to fire General Flynn because he lied to the vice president and the FBI. He has pled guilty to those lies. It's a shame because his actions during the transition were lawful. There was nothing to hide. Now, this tweet, people are saying, suggests that Trump knew that Flynn lied and seemed to show that Trump admits that he engaged in some kind of obstruction of justice in trying to cover up those lies or not coming forward about those lies, knowing about them as they were happening to the FBI without reporting that to the FBI. The other wrinkle to this now is that Trump's lawyer, John Dowd, says that he sent that tweet. It wasn't sent by the president, and he called it a mistake. This comes after a lot of people said that it very clearly spells out that President Trump engaged some kind of wrongdoing with this. This lawyer now is saying that that's not the case. He sent it. He won't be tweeting anymore, he says. He also says the president cannot commit obstruction of justice because he's the country's chief enforcer of the law, which is a comment that's getting a lot of attention. But how exactly he had access to this account, whether he did send this tweet, all unclear at the moment, still a lot of unanswered questions. But once again, we are seeing President Trump Twitter making some big news. Another issue that the president had been talking about in recent days is Time Magazine's Person of the Year.
Oh, yes.
We're getting towards the end of the year, so this is when they come out with the lists of people of the year, things of the year, what have you. And he had said that Time Magazine wanted to select him, but he told them no. Time Magazine shot back on Twitter and said that they don't notify people who are on the list. So that was a bit of back and forth. But Time has released their finalists for the Person of the Year this year. Trump is indeed on the list, along with Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, the Dreamers, which are the young undocumented immigrants living in the U.S., Patty Jenkins, the director of the film Wonder Woman, Kim Jong-un, Colin Kaepernick, who's led the NFL and national anthem protests, Robert Mueller, the former FBI director investigating everything, the Me Too movement, which is all the sexual harassment cases that we've been hearing about, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, and Chinese President Xi Jinping. So quite a list of luminaries throughout the world this year. We'll see who gets chosen on Wednesday. But right now, all of the talk is about these finalists and who might get selected. Judging on social media, it looks like there's a lot of attention on the Me Too movement. Of course, all of these claims of sexual harassment and assault have been dominating the news and social media in the past few weeks. So that has the early edge, but we will see what happens on Wednesday.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. We'll have to wait on Wednesday. Yeah, that's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Yemen's former president Saleh is killed. President Trump said the fired national security advisor, Michael Flynn, was treated unfairly. A Bollywood idol, Shashi Kapoor, dies at the age of 79. And Pakistan, Nepal, and Myanmar back away from Chinese projects, jolting Belt and Road plan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In the very center of our Milky Way galaxy, there's a huge, supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A. Located nearby is a region of space that is rocked by strong tidal forces and immersed in powerful ultraviolet light and X-ray radiation. Astronomers figure that this environment really shouldn't be an ideal location for stars to form, especially low-mass stars like our Sun. But new observations made with the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array reveals clues of 11 low-mass stars forming within only 3 light-years from the supermassive black hole. Scientists theorize that the existence of these young protostars suggests ideal conditions to form low-mass stars can not only be found in one of the most turbulent regions of our galaxy, but perhaps even in other similar locations throughout the universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Britain's Prince Harry leads a call for youth inclusion in HIV policy. Mm-hmm. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, told a conference on the Middle East in Washington Sunday the president is close to a decision on whether to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel and move the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv.
The president's going to make his decision, and he hasn't made his decision? He's still looking at a lot of different facts, and that when he makes his decision, he'll be the one to want to tell you, not me. So he'll make sure he does that at the right time.
A senior administration official indicated the decision could come Wednesday. Kushner, who has been Mr. Trump's envoy on Mideast peace, says he's optimistic the Trump administration has a real chance to achieve Israeli-Palestinian peace.
The president has a very long career of accomplishing things that a lot of people say were impossible. When we started the process of looking at how to create the peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the first thing a lot of people told us was that it wasn't the right time. The conditions weren't right. After years of distrust, we were really wasting our time to do it. The approach we've taken, even Barak Ravid wrote recently that the president's injected peace back into the discussions, and that's something we're very proud of because we do think it is achievable, and we think that there is a lot of reasons why this is a time, why it should happen.
Kushner said there are many instances of Israeli-Palestinian cooperation, but acknowledged there's little trust among the leadership, and that's what the latest U.S. effort is focused on. Arab League chief Ahmed Abdul Rait warned recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital would only stoke extremism and sink hopes for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Michael Fishbach, a history professor who closely watches the region, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he agrees.
It's hard to imagine that serious talks could go on because this is a game changer in terms of not just the current Israeli-Palestinian peace process that the U.S. has been trying to shepherd. It's a game changer as well in that it marks a drastic shift in American policy toward Jerusalem, toward Israel, toward the entire Middle East. And it sends a signal, really, to the United Nations. Countries have just about unanimously in the last 50 years declined to establish embassies or declare Jerusalem as the capital of Israel in respect for the UN decision to partition Palestine in 1947. So it's changing course on just about every level, and I can't see that anything good would come out of it.
What is the reason for the move?
I think the reason for the move, frankly, is domestic politics. I think President Trump, once again, is playing to a base. He's playing to a campaign promise. He's very keen on showing people who elected him that he's carrying out his campaign promises. Democratic, Republican, all administrations, and indeed most countries of the world have said, we're not going to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel or move embassies there pending any kind of final solution. I mean, this is truly, as I said, a game changer.
22 years ago, Congress passed a law allowing the embassy to move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So is this really that big a deal?
It is, because since that time, that's never happened. Even that decision back in the 90s was really a decision based on domestic American politics. There is an international consensus in the UN, outside the UN, about certain matters relating to the Arab-Israeli conflict. The fact that certain constituencies in the United States don't agree with those ground rules that have been established by the global community for decades is interesting, but it's not something that can be done away with willy-nilly. It's a very dangerous precedent, and I would urge the president to exercise great caution in this regard.
That's Professor Michael Fishbach. Palestinians want East Jerusalem as a capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said any step to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital or moving the U.S. embassy there would represent a threat to the peace process and would be unacceptable to Palestinians in the Arab world. Governments must do far more to include the needs of young people in the global fight against HIV and AIDS. That's according to a new report. Despite progress in tackling the disease, it is estimated that 1,700 new HIV infections occur every day among young people around the world, and the problem is particularly acute in Africa. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
It is time policymakers recognised that HIV-positive adolescents face unique challenges, says the report from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine alongside the charity Centre Bali. Among the recommendations are that young people receive adequate psychosocial support, a human rights-based approach to testing and care, and finding ways to sensitively discuss sex and relationships for adolescents living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Professor Rashida Ferrand co-authored the research.
We really need to be thinking about all the barriers at every step in that broad environment, both at facility level and in clinics, etc., but also recognizing the fact that most of the time young people do not spend in facilities. So we have to think of modifying the environments and the barriers that those environments place.
Campaigners say many adolescents in Africa are unaware of their HIV status and are afraid to get tested. 23-year-old Masedi Kewamodimo was born with HIV. Both her parents died from AIDS. Growing up in her native Botswana, Masedi grew frustrated with the barriers she faced and decided to reveal her HIV status in order to campaign for better treatment. She spoke to VOA about that decision.
It's one of the most difficult thing I've ever faced in my whole life. Every single day I face stigma. People talk about it because one, they fear it. Two, they assume certain people within our society have it. Three, they feel that they cannot welcome people who are living with HIV and AIDS.
The charity Centre Bali, which helped put together the policy recommendations, was co-founded by Prince Harry, who is newly engaged to American actress Meghan Markle. She has also campaigned on health issues in Africa. Earlier this year, the Prince chaired a meeting in London on adolescents with HIV, titled Let Youth Lead, and called for a change in global education on the disease.
Young people, the first time they know or the first time they hear anything about HIV and AIDS is probably by the time it's too late. Whether it's in the education system here in the UK, whether it's across Africa, whether it's across the world, HIV needs to be treated exactly the same as any other disease.
Campaigners hope the royal couple's star power will help them spread the vital message that young people's needs and fears must be addressed in the global drive to tackle HIV and AIDS. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition, the eighth installment in the Star Wars saga. Star Wars: The Last Jedi opens in U.S. theaters this month. But as VOA's David Byrd tells us, the opening is bittersweet after the death last December of Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia to millions of fans.
We first met Princess Leia in 1977 when Carrie Fisher starred as the young but feisty leader of a rebel alliance battling the evil Galactic Empire. Fisher had finished all of her scenes for The Last Jedi before she died last December. Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, to Star Wars fans, says that he is still struggling with Fisher's death.
She was meant to be much more prominent in 9. But wait till you see her in the movie. She is just wonderful. We'll have to find a way to give her closure in 9, but we'll never be able to replace her. And there'll always be a hole in my heart because I loved her so much.
Writer-director Rian Johnson says that Fisher was first and foremost a writer, and some of her creative ad-libs made their way into the script.
And so my main memories of her are hanging out with her before the shoot and just like going through the script, and she would just throw out one-liners mostly and puns and jokes, and I would just scribble down all these like wordplay things she was throwing out and then maybe find a spot for one of them in the scene. But she was something else, man. She was really one of a kind.
John Boyega, who plays the stormtrooper-turned-rebel Finn, says that Fisher gives a nuanced performance in The Last Jedi.
It's a performance that requires a heartfelt approach, and I think she definitely had that. Now, I don't know how she had that while, you know, creating havoc on set with the jokes and the laughter. She just gets straight back into a zen that is, and a seriousness that's required for this film. It's good to see them.
Director Rian Johnson says that it's up to director J.J. Abrams and writer Chris Terrio, who are working on the next Star Wars film, to decide what to do about Leia's character.
We had completely shot her part out and were in post-production already when she passed away, so we had a complete performance from her here. And I'm just, you know, however it gets handled in the future, I'm very thankful that we have this from her.
Mark Hamill says that recasting the character is out of the question. No one could replace Carrie Fisher as Leia.
Star Wars is about great triumphs, but great tragedies. And I can't think of a bigger tragedy than missing our Leia.
Star Wars The Last Jedi opens in U.S. theaters December 15th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, Star Wars, always a popular saga of films. Well, that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Through its binational commission with Nigeria, the U.S. hopes to find new areas of collaboration with regard to security cooperation, economic growth and development, and democracy and governance. In the northwest region of Nigeria, Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa have wrought a great deal of destruction on the Nigerian people, forcing more than 2 million to flee from their homes. Speaking in Nigeria, Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan said, "I want to emphasize that the United States is Nigeria's partner in this fight. We are committed to helping the Nigerian people provide their own security." The U.S. has helped Nigeria modernize its military, but a military response alone in the Northeast cannot lead to sustained peace, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. Nigeria's success requires improvements to the economy and governance off the battlefield, including credible investigations of human rights violations and mechanisms to hold those guilty accountable for their actions. To help those affected by Boko Haram rebuild their lives, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced that the U.S. Agency for International Development will contribute an additional $45.5 million. The United States will continue to support food security and nutrition programs in Nigeria, including development programs focused on the northeastern states. Predictable economic policies and a transparent justice system are necessary to create an environment for growth and to attract businesses and investment to Nigeria. Sufficient energy resources are critical to fueling growth in Nigeria. Through the U.S. government's Power Africa initiative, the U.S. will help the Nigerian government serve the majority of Nigerians who currently lack access to electricity. In particular, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced a $1.3 million project to address the shortage of gas available for gas-fired power plants under the Power Africa initiative. Finally, in addition to supporting the security and economic growth of Nigeria, the United States recognizes that good governance is necessary to sustain both over the long term. Fighting corruption and ensuring free and fair elections will make the government of Nigeria more accountable to its people and better equipped to secure its citizens and keep its economy growing. the United States looks forward to working with Nigeria to reach their shared security, development, and governance goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.